The Guardian.
The Weekly Cardiff Special Edition. Yesterday, Marco Materazzi. Today, the old lady. Zidane using his head to down another Italian in a final as Real Madrid makes it 12 titles and Juventus doesn't. We salute the Zid, hear from Sid, and marvel at what Ronaldo did. Plus, we are 7 defeats in 9 appearances is the only way Juve could have a worse record in finals if they attended Trump University. All of that coming up in this very special Football Weekly. That's right, listeners. Thank you so much for joining us today for this very special souvenir edition of the Cardiff Champions League final, Real Madrid 4, Juventus 1. Today we have a man who was there, Sasha Gurionov.
Good morning, James.
Good morning to you, Sasha. A man who did the minute-by-minute on this event, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
A man who sat at home and watched it with beer, James Horncastle.
Good day to you, James.
And another man who didn't actually watch the game until the next, well, a little bit, half that night until I fell asleep, and then the next morning I caught up on the rest.
Tell us the good story about...
Well, there were a lot of pod listeners actually at the event that I attended, which involved a man in a waistcoat and leather kecks. And yes, it was Depeche Mode. He was the man in waistcoat and leather kecks. anyway, Dave Gahan. But there were a lot of people came and said, oh, you couldn't shift your tickets, Jimbo. Anyway, one of these folk came along and said, oh, have you heard the score? I said, please don't tell me, but is it worth watching? And he said, yes, I think you'll find the result very interesting. So I went home going, whoa, you have crushed it. Switched on, and when Mandzukic scored, I thought, here we go, lads. Fair to say that I found the second half as bewildering as many people, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Sasha, you were there at the Millennium Stadium. It's no longer called that, is it?
Principality Stadium.
The Principality Stadium.
To me, it's still the Millennium.
The Welsh really don't like it being called the Principality Stadium. Right. So I think, and in The Guardian, we call it the Millennium Stadium, so let's go with Millennium Stadium.
All right. And from the moment that Black Eyed Peas stepped on stage, it was just an electric night, I imagine.
The thing is, last time I went to the Champions League final was 10 years ago in Athens. This was very different. I mean, my sort of memories of an opening ceremony, for example, Istanbul's like loads of conscripts just running around. And this was like the Super Bowl.
Right.
Yeah, so I think, I don't know, it just felt very American.
But the Super Bowl from the kind of mid-noughties, given that the Black Eyed Peas were playing.
Oh, possibly, yes. Yeah. So basically, football's 10 years behind American football, then.
I guess so.
I have a massive beef with the immediate beforemath and aftermath of the game, which we could probably get to later.
No, I think now's the time.
Well, it's just UEFA's seeming determination to ruin this marquee event is baffling. Well, I suppose it's not that baffling because it's UEFA, but, you know, you've got these two wonderful sets of fans crammed into this fantastic stadium. I mean, I've only ever seen rugby matches there, but it is a brilliant stadium to watch sport in. The lid is on, you know, it's a cauldron. And then they have some banter merchant. I knew Max Rushton was there, and I'm really hoping it wasn't him, although part of me hopes it was. But, you know, sort of cheerleading the crowd and ruining the atmosphere they would have been perfectly capable of generating on their own. Then Juve's players are out warming up before the game. They're sort of ushered off so that this giant pitch-sized canvas can be spread out over the field. Then the stage comes out. This awful band comes out and does their thing. And then at the end of the game, kickoff is delayed by a couple of minutes because of these farcical scenes, which again do nothing for the atmosphere. And then at the end of the game, there's so many people on the pitch that it families, kids, an army of photographers restricting the players' every move as they try to celebrate with the trophy and with their fans. It just seemed to suck all the atmosphere out.
Where do you
the
stand
occasion.
On kids? Where do you stand on kids on pitches, Barry?
I'm not a fan, I have to say. Right. It left me pining for the days when I used to watch European Cup finals on TV and there was a commentary coming down a crackly phone line. Players used to just kick lumps out of each other for 90 minutes and then, you know, the winning 11 or 13 or whatever celebrated with the trophy.
Well, between all of that, we had...
I probably sound like a total Grinch, don't I?
No, I don't. I think a lot of people are nodding along in empathy there. Let's hear if Sid Lowe is one of them. Sid, who was in Cardiff, is joining us in London this evening for a special Foot Weekly live show. But right now, Sid Lowe, has just cleared security at Barajas Airport in Madrid. Right. You've seen the papers this morning. You saw the papers, more importantly, Sunday morning. What was the reaction in Spain?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's stating the bleeding obvious, but the reaction was excitement, a sense of triumphalism, a sense... I mean, this is a curious thing to say, but I think one of the things that's most striking about the response to Cardiff, and actually I think the way we all probably felt in the stadium as well, not just the way that the Spanish media has responded since, is that this feels like the beginning of something. And one of the reasons why I say that's a bit strange in a way is because it's the beginning of something. Well, what? They've won three of the last four. It already is something. Hmm. But it does feel like the beginning of something. I think because Zidane is only just starting out, even though he's now won, and I love this particular statistic, Jimbo, he's been in charge for 20 European Cup games, only 20, and he's already won as many European Cups as Guardiola, Ferguson or Mourinho. Mm. But it does feel like the start of something. I think it feels like the start of something, not because of the European Cup itself, although obviously that helps, but because it goes hand in hand with the league title. And, you know, Real Madrid hadn't won the league for 5 years. There was a sense, even when they won those last two European Cups, that kind of, not that it was accidental or that it was even incidental or even that it was a one-off. There was always a sense that they could win it again, but a sense that they weren't really the best team around. I think now there's a real feeling for the first time that, okay, this is the best team in Europe now, and this is a team that could perhaps go and win more.
Sid, let's talk about the manager. Andrew Vickers says, what does Sid think Zizi brings to Real Madrid? Is he just a figure the players listen to and respect, or smart tactical personnel decisions? You wrote, it's time to acknowledge Zidane. For what, yeah. Sid?
Well, I mean, I think the first point he makes is absolutely true. I think Zidane is someone who connects to the players better than perhaps other coaches have done. We're talking about, and it's not a phrase I particularly like, but I must confess I can't think of another one. We're talking about ultra elite level. We're talking about the very best players in the world. And when you look at the difference between, and I know this is perhaps a little bit unfair, but you look at the difference between Zidane and Rafa Benitez, and there's something that I keep going back to, but I think kind of helps to explain this. Benitez's nickname among the players was El Diez, the number 10. This kind of sarcastic nickname. Here's this guy, you know, who was never Maradona, who never really played. I think a knee injury stopped him when he was at the World Student Games in 1971, and that never reached the top level. And he's trying to tell us how to do things that we know how to do. And Ronaldo, for example, complaining that Benitez was trying to show him how to take free kicks. Benitez told Luka Modric that pass that he does so often with the outside of his foot, you know, that's not technically the best way to do that pass, but it's what Modric does. And by the way, it's what he does brilliantly. And the difference between that and Zidane going and sitting in a press conference and going, oof, those passes that Modric does with the outside of his foot, whoa, aren't they brilliant? And so you've got this guy that understands them and kind of embraces what they do rather than tries to correct them all the time.
Hmm. Are you sat next to Rafa Benitez? Because you're speaking in a really hushed voice. I was just wondering.
Oh, sorry. No. I think it's partly that my voice is going. It's partly that I'm sitting in the airport. And I suppose I don't want Barajas Airport to get a kind of a free preview of the Guardian podcast.
Brilliant. Okay. Which is also free, of course, listeners. Sid, sorry, you were halfway through. So they respect Zidane more.
So that's part of it. And I think there's part of it which comes from just the status of being who he is. So as I say, you've got Benitez, this sarcastic nickname, the number 10. This guy never made it. He's trying to tell us what to do. Well, Zidane tries to tell you what to do, or in fact, more to the point, doesn't try and tell you what to do. But Zidane is there. He's someone you listen to by definition. You know, you've got Benitez who tells Ronaldo how to take a free kick. Zidane who, rather than telling him, challenges him a training ground game. The two of them take a load of free kicks together, and they do it. And Zidane wins, by the way. And you get this situation where, so there's an immediate respect there that comes from status. But then Zidane has reinforced that by, I think, understanding them, by managing them very well, by, as I say, listening and encouraging rather than trying to impose and correct constantly. I think beyond that, there's been one or two little tactical tweaks that have been important. I think there's one key thing, perhaps, which is that he pushed through the idea that Casemiro always plays. And that looked bloody obvious now, but it wasn't back then. And it certainly wasn't in terms of a political decision. I think one of the things that Benitez did that destroyed him was playing with a team that he himself didn't believe in the Clásico and losing. Had he won, then maybe he'd have got away with it, and losing. He took the political decision rather than the one that he really wanted tactically and paid for it. And then the other thing I think, and one of the big things that Zidane has done, is he has been, and maybe this comes from being in Italy, Jimbo, you'll know this better than me, he has been absolutely obsessed with Real Madrid's physical condition and the physical preparation this season, much more than last, because, of course, he didn't have a pre-season then. This season, I think the physical preparation has been exceptional.
Mm, yeah, well, they certainly look like they peaked in a way that Juventus couldn't.
Sid, there were rumours which turned out to be cobblers that Gareth Bale might start swirling around about an hour before kickoff. Was there any suggestion that Zidane might have come under pressure to start Bale instead of Isco?
No, I mean, in a way, I mean, we talked about this, didn't we, on, was it Thursday or Friday? But when Bale came out and spoke to us on Tuesday, it wasn't just that he was effectively saying, I would accept it if I don't start. It was that he expected that. And actually, I think in an implicit kind of way, I don't want to push this too far, but I felt like he was effectively asking not to start. He was saying, look, we all know it's not right that I start. We know I'm not fully fit. We know Isco has played brilliantly. I hope to play a part. And then after the game, he more or less confirmed that. So he said, look, I didn't know until whatever it is, 2 or 3 hours before the game, whether or not I was starting. But deep down, I did know, really. You know, I'd only been with my teammates training for 5 or 6 weeks. Someone's got a hammer out, which isn't very helpful. I've only been with my teammates for 5 or 6 days. I knew I wasn't fully fit. Isco had been playing well. So there wasn't really any sense that this was going to happen. And because Bale had said that, and because Zidane had seen this through, and because Madrid were playing so well, I think at Real Madrid long term, maybe there can be pressure for Bale to get back into the side and to start again, and then maybe that shifts things. But for this specific game, in this particular moment, no.
Mm. Sid, David Pudge asking whether Real's success means that they can get away with not signing a big name this summer, or is the fact that they've won the double irrelevant, they want a new player anyway? What's the feeling, Sid?
No, I mean, look, in a way, both of those things are true. There's always that desire to kind of add a little bit of that word that Florentino Perez, the president, always uses, ilusión, kind of hope or excitement or dream almost, if you like. There isn't a proper translation for it. But having won this after the game, Florentino Perez himself said that, you know, you don't need to change anything. This is perfect. You don't need to do anything now. Why would we? Now, I think they will. It wouldn't surprise me if there is a star among their signings. But there is, they are, of course, now in a situation when any kind of pressure to do so has completely disappeared. There should, in theory, be presidential elections this summer. I don't think there will, because I think no one will stand against Florentino Perez. I think there's lots of reasons why no one would stand against Florentino Perez. But the fact they've just won this double makes that guaranteed. They're very kindly telling us about making sure we're careful with our luggage. And so I don't think there's a pressure to do so. I think they might make one or two signings. By the way, there will be departures as well, of course. I mean, James is likely to go.
Where to, Sid?
I don't actually know where James will go. I mean, there was that talk about Manchester United. I must admit, I was never completely won over by that, but I'm not saying it's not true, but it never felt a very natural fit. Morata, obviously, it will depend on who comes for him and what the offers are. There's been suggestions that AC Milan are interested. I think he would rather go to the Premier League, but you know, what he wants is to play and to be a regular starter. And I think he recognises that it's not necessarily you know, a scandal or anything that he doesn't play for Real Madrid, but he recognises it. It's a reality that he would rather avoid. And so they will go. And I think Madrid will probably try with Hazard, but maybe not try as hard as they once would have done. And I think they will still try with a goalkeeper. There is a sense that while Kaylor Navas has been exceptional, I think, in the last couple of months, the rest of the season perhaps wasn't brilliant. But there's also a sense that, you know, he deserves to be in this team. He's been good enough for Real Madrid. He's definitely a Real Madrid-level goalkeeper. But maybe, being objective and honest about it, there are still better goalkeepers out there that they could try and get.
Sid, you got a flight to catch. Let me leave you with one statistic. I'm sure you're aware of it. The last 11 European trophies available, Spanish clubs have won 10 of them. 10! Sid, have a great trip. We'll see you in London Monday night. We haven't talked about Ronaldo yet. Extraordinary. What did you make of him live there, Sasha?
He doesn't move much anymore, does he?
But he doesn't need to.
Exactly. I know people have been saying, you know, about him changing his style. But it's interesting, I haven't seen him live for a very long time. He's just much more effective now rather than flamboyant. Mm. And I mean, the goal that, the first goal, people say deflection, Buffon, etc. But you could see that he was just placing it in the corner and he was just in the right place. I think it was pretty much the only time Carvajal got forward properly in the first half as well. But they picked that moment, and it was also very key because those first 20 minutes from Real, they weren't very good and they were quite pinned back. In fact, I would say the whole of the first half, I thought it was remarkable how bad Real's defending was because A, positioning wasn't great, and B, every time they tried to pass it out the back, they seemed to lose the ball. Marcelo lost the ball about three or four times in really simple situations. He was completely at sea.
And Casemiro lost the ball a lot in the first half.
They just couldn't hold the ball. And compared to them, the Juventus players had Velcro touches, and they looked like a proper Polish team. And at halftime, you were thinking, there's only one winner here.
Mm. Yeah, that extraordinary equaliser after Ronaldo's goal from Mandzukic, which saw the ball hoofed upfield by Bonucci and then not touching the ground until it nestled in the net.
You know, with that, I think they did it on... I think that was almost... Okay, pass was obviously intentional, but two times before that, they hit the ball at Mandzukic. Uh-huh. And this time, it looked like the pass was overhit. So I thought the Real Madrid defence just stopped for a second and Sandro used that time to run behind and obviously flick it back. Because I think they were expecting the ball to Mandzukic and they thought this was an overhit pass.
Right, and I don't think anyone was expecting Mandzukic to do what he did. Why on earth would he think of doing something like that?
He was placed. You're watching his body. He was placing it over his shoulder, into the far corner. But
he has always been a man for the big occasion, you know, in a way that, say, his teammate Gonzalo Higuain is very much not a man for the big occasion.
Higuain would say he set that goal up, having the last touch.
He did, yeah. It was a nice little chest down. Marouane Fellaini would have been very proud. I mean, Cristiano Ronaldo didn't actually touch the ball, I think, for 9 minutes, the first 9 minutes.
Yeah. I did like what was believed he said after scoring that goal, which was just one chance, bang. And that was it, because it was their first counter-attack, first shot, and he's a killer. And yeah, up until that point, Juventus had maybe three chances, a couple for Higuain, one for Pjanic. And Allegri was quite keen to point out after the game that Pjanic's shot in the first half, which drew a really good save from Navas, if that had got a nick, if that had got a deflection, a little bit like Casemiro's, then it perhaps would have gone in. And I mean, yeah, the Italians were kind of, they were gracious and they said, look, second half, Juventus just could not live with Real Madrid. But certain things on the night didn't go their way. And that was what Buffon was really complaining about. It's like, you know, they had a couple of deflected goals. Third goal was magnificent. And then the fourth goal was when they were down to 10 men after Cuadrado was kind of really harshly sent off after some magnificent play acting from Sergio Ramos.
He did step on his foot, though.
Well, I thought Ramos had a... I mean, everyone, their attention was drawn to that. But he completely stopped Dybala getting into the game. He was an animal. Was Ramos.
Why were Juve arguably certainly shading it as the better side in the first half and couldn't live with Real in the second half? What happened at halftime?
Allegri said that in the first half they just played with their foot constantly on the accelerator, and physically in the second half they were gassed. But I also think there was a mental aspect to it as well, that quick 1-2 of the second and third goals. It was a little bit like what happened to Atletico in finals gone by in recent memory, where all the kind of ghosts that they'd hoped to lay to rest just come back. And there was this kind of not self-fulfilling prophecy of anything, but all of a sudden it's like, nothing goes our way in finals, do they? We always lose finals. Whereas Real Madrid, by contrast, always win finals. And for half an hour in the second half, it was game over. And you could see, even before Cuadrado got sent off, one of Allegri's changes was to take off Dybala for Lamina, and it became damage limitation.
Dybala had very disappointing performance. Yeah. I know you had high hopes for him, but I thought in the first half, Luka Modric seemed to have to come deep looking for the ball quite a lot. Ronaldo was kind of wandering around trying to, you know, he wasn't getting many touches. I mean, obviously he scored two goals, one touch for each, and they were both magnificent. But that seemed to sort itself out in the second half, because Real Madrid just upped the tempo, their forward, slick, fast passing, and Juve just didn't seem to have any answers for that.
Can I chip in with some love for Isco here? Uh-huh. He got thunderous reception from Real fans when he was taken off. And for me, the difference in the second half was Isco drifted across sort of the front line in the first half. But at the start of the second half, the first 15 minutes, he and Marcelo really attacked the right flank of the Juventus defence. And that kind of destabilised the whole lot. He got behind after about 55 minutes really nicely and pulled it back to the edge of the box. And I think at that stage, as you were saying, you know, doubt is creeping into Juventus' mind. And then it just basically became a huge implosion. Having said that, I thought when Juventus scored, I was sitting next to a Russian colleague of mine. He said, goal's coming. 5 seconds later, bang. And you could feel it, that there was so much pressure building. It's going to have to be unleashed. But Buffon was extremely unlucky with the deflection because he was saving it, unless it was in this very, very corner.
Mm. Was there much reaction, much criticism of Allegri in Italy?
There was in after the second half performance, because they looked at the midfield battle and they said, look, you've got Pjanic and Khedira in there against former Real Madrid players, you know, in Isco, Casemiro, Modric and Kroos. Hmm. And yeah, I think he gambled on the belief that Juventus could win the game down the flanks, where they could double up against Real Madrid's fullbacks and have Dybala and Alves on one side and Sandro and Mandzukic on the other. And as Sasha was saying, they kept playing it over to Mandzukic in the belief that he could kind of win the physical battle with Carvajal. But in the second half, Carvajal got forward more. Modric came across to help him out. And they were able to move the game back into the middle, and Juventus couldn't live with it. And you could see Pjanic had to come off with a knee injury shortly after the second half began. He perhaps could have been withdrawn sooner. Khedira was only a game, an hour back from an injury from the semi-final second leg against Monaco. And then in terms of like the changes that he could make, the only attacking option he had on the bench was Cuadrado. And it didn't affect the game in the way he'd liked.
No. Ronaldo, with his two goals, is that now 8 goals in the last three?
Ten and five.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Yeah.
So hat-tricks
ten from the quarterfinals on.
Right. Ten.
Two threes, two and two, I think.
Amazing. And some people arguing that he's having basically the greatest year in football history, European Championships, or has had, rather, European Championships, Champions League, La Liga and the Ballon d'Or, all won for him in the space of about 12 months. A gentleman who, of course, was whistled by the Real Madrid fans just over a month ago. Sasha, it seems like you're poised to come.
But he scored the fewest goals in 8 years?
Really?
Yeah, he's only scored 43, and before there was always over 50.
Right.
Yeah.
7 years of 40 or more goals every season is
just amazing.
I think Zizou deserves immense credit for the way he's handled Ronaldo, actually, because he's been very brave. He left him out for a number of away games towards the end of the season to try and keep him fresh. That could have gone horribly wrong for Real, could have cost them the title. Presumably, Ronaldo always wants to play because he loves being the centre of attention. He wants to keep racking up those goals. So, you know, it's a difficult decision for Zidane to make, but he made it anyway. And, it worked, but it could have gone so wrong for him. You know, they could have lost the title and could have lost the European Cup.
Mm. Do you know what we haven't mentioned so far? Marcelo, that big Dani Alves Marcelo duel. Marcelo absolutely stormed it, huh?
Yeah. I thought Marcelo didn't have a great first half.
What? You know, first half, okay.
Second half, yes, completely.
Because Dani Alves won the first half, yeah. I guess, without that much in terms of...
I don't think Alves really did very much in the first half, but he was just better than Marcelo, because I think Marcelo was so poor.
Right.
But then second half, Marcelo, yeah, just completely destroyed that flank.
Yeah. Okay. Was this Juve's shot, do you think, reclaiming the Champions League, or can they come back? Are they in a position to bounce back, get back to the final and lose that next year as well?
I think what was really disappointing for Juventus was that, unlike 2 years ago when they didn't expect to reach the final, let alone win it, they believed they could get there this time and thought they had more than a puncher's chance of winning it. And they actually stayed in the game longer 2 years ago than they did this time around. And as Sasha was saying before we came on air, there wasn't really much of a presence from Real Madrid fans in Cardiff.
They were there, but they weren't there, if you know what I mean. They were very sort of relaxed, comfortable. We're middle-class Real fans. We're going to win this anyway. But there was a real feeling with Juventus fans. I mean, travelling up on the train from London, walking through central Cardiff, so this passion that people talk about, they really believed that they can do this time. Confident, and so there was fire in the belly for Juventus fans. And then
how was it going back?
People queuing to Cardiff Station just wanted to get out of the place. But it was really weird after the game. You wander around through Cardiff and it's like a Saturday night and the locals are going out, you know, dressed up to the nines and everything. And then these random tens of thousands of these Juventus and Madrid fans just wandering around in a daze. There was a couple of guys sitting on the curb tucking into this massive sausage and chips in their Real shirts. And I was just looking and going, this is just... I can't compute. But then... Of course, one of the criticisms of Cardiff beforehand was there's only 4,000 hotel beds, so people couldn't really stay in the place. Mm. I think everything else, the place is perfect. It's a stadium next to the station, next to all the bars. It's like, for me, it's the perfect football location. And I have to say, I think eventually they sort of figured out what to do with these crowds, because there was trains to London every 15 minutes after the match.
Well, Cardiff generally tends to feature prominently in a certain newspaper's sort of hand-wringy State of Britain Saturday Night Out exposés. So I don't know, did you...
I've been on the stag do to Cardiff. It's fantastic.
Oh, no, I'm not criticising it at all, but there is a certain sanctimonious British newspaper that gets on its high horse every now and then and publishes galleries of photos with women in short skirts vomiting and lying on the pavement with their legs akimbo. Disgraceful scenes.
Really? It was an old lady that was lying prone.
I don't think her legs were akimbo, though.
Well, they were pretty wide open, I think, probably. And poor Buffon. I mean, so many people have got on that Buffon bandwagon. But, you know, he's won the World Cup.
But I think it was torture washing him. He was in so much pain.
He's won the World Cup. You can't
have
everything.
I thought it was amazing when Mandzukic's goals went in. You could tell he was all of a sudden sort of full of confidence again, and almost like jumped over the advertising hoardings to go and celebrate with the fans as if they'd already won it.
Mm.
But when they touched down yesterday, he did say, look, I've still got a year left on my contract.
Do you see them making it to the final again next year?
I mean, this has been quite a remarkable run anyway, when you think it's two finals in 3 years, and when you think in that 2 years they've changed 16 players. So they show they can rebuild. They've put a lot of deals in place already ahead of next season. Got quite a lot of young players that
they've
signed. Which
player are you most excited about that's arriving?
Well, if Patrick Schick arrives, he's very exciting, very Bergkamp-esque. But I think the worry is the core, because the core is getting old. You look at particularly Bonucci and Chiellini. Chiellini had a very bad game. Buffon. They've signed players who can replace them long term, like Caldada, Rugani. I think these guys have still got a year. Be very interesting to see what they do in the summer, because Allegri was saying after the game that they kind of changed system in January to 4-2-3-1, and that left them maybe a little bit short-handed in the wide areas. They want to buy more wingers, so I think we'll see them do that in the summer. They've been linked with players like Douglas Costa, Angel Di Maria, so I think they can go again.
Am I right in saying they've earned more from this Champions League campaign than Real have the winners?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, this is what they can console themselves with. They've earned €109 million just from Champions League TV money and prize money. So obviously not all of that will be reinvested, but a significant amount will. Mm.
Isn't that significantly less than Sunderland?
Coming bottom of the Premier League, they got €103 million.
And their wage bill is higher than Atletico Madrid's.
Sunderland's?
Yeah.
Really? Wow. We should also mention the very distressing scenes at the sort of fan zone in the centre. Was it Piazza San Carlo? Was it?
Yeah.
Of Turin, where 1,500 people injured or something. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And this was a stampede caused by... there have been a lot of theories. Have they reached any kind of conclusion about what's caused the...
Well, one was that it was a prank... gone terribly wrong of someone pretending to be a terrorist. And you can understand, given some of the things that have happened at events like that, how much panic that would cause. The other is just the organisation of the event. There were pat-down searches as people went in, but people were allowed to carry glass bottles into Piazza San Carlo. And a lot of these bottles, which just kind of dropped, fell on the ground. And obviously when this panic was caused, a lot of the injuries were from shattered glass on the square. And obviously the local authority coming under a lot of criticism, because there should have been better security measures, better crowd control put in place. But they've basically said, oh, well, we did the same 2 years ago. But clearly, if the same had happened 2 years ago, the same problems would have happened. So I think...
I don't know if you saw the TV footage of it. It was really distressing. It's like just this crowd and then this kind of wave, rippling domino effect sweeps down. And I'm amazed no one was killed, really.
It's also an enclosed piazza, so therefore you can't really get out easily.
Well, I mean, there are four exits. But I think one of the issues in particular was there was a there was an underground car park where you could just get in and out, and people were bringing firecrackers.
Right.
People were bringing
alcohol. The benefit of 2020 hindsight, I mean, wouldn't the thing to do have been to have it at the stadium?
Precisely.
I mean, at the Bernabeu, there was, I think, 81,000 watching it on 8 big screens.
All right.
They had screens like around the centre circle, didn't they?
Yeah, perhaps next time. Now, we're going to be back with a little bit more chat after this. Well, the season's pretty much over, but the chat continues. A lot of listeners with some pretty interesting things to say. Here's Daniel Cianillo, who says, how about a shout for Zidane as the best, most successful player to have become as good, successful a manager? Chris Renwick says, hey, Beckenbauer, surely though Dalglish would have had a shout if English teams hadn't been banned from Europe. Interesting. Daniel comes back at him. Good shout, he says. I thought Cesare Maldini, perhaps, or Zagallo, who won the World Cup as a player, manager, and assistant manager, in brackets, I think. He then kind of blots his copybook by mentioning Passarello. I don't know necessarily.
No, Johan Cruyff in there.
Cruyff, there you go. Cruyff.
So maybe is it super players managing super players rather than
brought
the rank
lower down?
I think
that's very much the thing. Nice to see Zizou mentioned in that context. Chris Rennick then gets bored of that conversation, starts a new one called Worst Good Player Turned Manager. He's got money on Ardiles. He also finds time to mention Alan Shearer. Producer Ben shouting Ince, Gazza and Platt. Basically England, but any England player. That's Producer Ben's point. Oh, here's Daniel Cianillo again. Sorry, you guys can have a word if you want.
Well, Daniel's doing fine.
They should be on the pod. Yeah, exactly. Maradona and Mateus. Luther Mateus, that's good. Best player turned waiting staff, Tony Adams, of course. He's got that one.
But Tony Adams, funnily enough, he's worked really, really hard to be as underwhelming a manager as he is thus far been. I mean, as I said the other day, I'm reading his book, Sober. You know, he's.
Is that what it's called, or just your approach?
Well, both. Yeah. But, you know, he after retiring, he's done all his badges, got all the qualifications, did a degree in sports science. You know, because as a recovering alcoholic who's just given up football, he's a lot of time on his hands. So then he took the Wickham job, admits himself that he was out of pocket doing that job. He was on, I think, 70 grand a year, but said he spent so much money going around scouting players, buying equipment for the club, paying for it out of his own pocket, stuff like that, that he ended up out of. It ended up costing him money, but he left that job because he was disillusioned that the players he was coaching weren't good enough, and he wanted to be coaching better players. But it's kind of smacked of a kind of arrogance that, you know, you have to earn the right to do that, maybe. And he then went to work for Feyenoord for quite a long time, and he was working with their reserves, kids, all age levels. He was going around doing scouting for Arsenal in France, in Holland, in Belgium, all over the place. So, you know, he really, really has worked very hard, but it doesn't seem to be doing him any good. So maybe just, it's certainly not a case that he's lazy. Maybe he's just not cut out for management at the top level.
It's a shame, isn't it?
Is he still at Granada?
Yes, I think the plan is for him to, when they installed him, Sid said, you know, they were more or less resigned to relegation. I think he played 7, lost 7, scored very few goals. But the plan is for him to manage them next season.
Is he not moving kind of upstairs to a kind of...
Well, he said, I don't know if the plan has changed since his short tenures thus far has been so disastrous. He's mates with the guy who owns Granada, isn't he? That's the connection.
I believe so. On the subject of people being upstairs or anywhere, we did talk on Thursday about Jorge Mendes being Wolves' official director of sport. No, says Symphony. He says that would be Kevin Thelwell, who's been at the club since 2008. Mendes has no official role at Wolves. And was unlikely, continues Symphony, to have been the driving force behind the only signing the club has made, the out-of-contract former Norwich defender Ryan Bennett. Also, we claim they've sacked everyone. No, Paul Lambert was removed, and as is common, his assistant went with him, and all other members of staff remain the same, apart from the head of sports science. Who was saying all this nonsense
me.
On our pod? Was that
it's
you,
me.
James?
Yeah.
Defend yourself, sir.
Well, what's official, what's unofficial, isn't it?
Right, OK.
Well...
Yeah.
The owners at Wolves own half of Mendes's agency, don't they? So effectively, who works
Jesty
for them?
Foot.
Yeah. Mm. Fusson.
That's the company that owns Wolves.
Yeah. So have it, you, Symphony. I think. Look behind the, you know, between the lines. Nice one, Sasha. Follow the money. Can't think of a good name. Says, next season, can we have a pod with AC Jimbo, Ian McIntosh, Max Rushton and Dave Farrar? Make it so, producer Ben. Would you like listening to that, Sasha?
Of course.
Who would present it?
I don't know. We'd all present
all
it.
All presented at once.
Do a part each.
Yeah. I thought that would be a sizzling, a crackling atmosphere.
It's kind of like the Travelling Wilburys. Yeah. Podcasting.
Yeah. Nicholas Ward's got a podcast suggestion. He wants one... did a review old movies that people haven't seen. I'm sure somebody does this already. They certainly do with that Ram Album Club. No, yeah. There's the Ram Album Club, which is all about people who've not heard a classic album, listening to it, and then basically, you know, presenting the evidence of their fresh ears. But Nicholas Ward saw The Goonies with a friend who hadn't seen it and thought it was so now he wants us to do a podcast about that.
He didn't like The Goonies.
I've never seen it, Barry. Perhaps what? I'll watch it over the summer and make a podcast about it.
Magnificent.
Really? Oh, yeah. Magnificent? Sasha, have you seen it?
No.
Right, you're in my podcast then. Yeah. James, well,
it's fantastic.
All right,
when I was a kid, I saw The Lost Boys. I thought it was the greatest film I'd ever seen. And then I saw it again as an adult. I thought it was awful.
Really?
But... as a kid, I saw The Goonies, thought it was one of the greatest films I've ever seen, and then saw it again as an adult and stand over my opinion. So it stands the test of time and what passes for maturity in my world.
Okay, producer Ben is shaking his head violently from side to side saying no, which I'm taking as a sign of encouragement to discuss The Lost Boys. You remember that scene where they're all hanging from the bridge?
I think we've had this conversation before, but I do remember, yes.
Do you remember how it finishes? And there's all that dry ice and he's being dared to explore his new vampire powers and drop from the bridge into the abyss below. That bridge is a metre off the ground. It's a metre off the ground and there's water underneath it. I was so disappointed when I saw that. We talked about drummers. If you're a fan of drummers, you'll like bands that have two drummers in them. I was excited about the fact that Zig Zig Sputnik, who you were quite possibly a member of as like Moscow Street Gang... Are they a famous Moscow Street Gang?
No.
Okay.
Anyway. It's the first time I've heard of this street gang.
Have you heard of the band, though, Sash?
No.
Really?
It was completely new discovery for me.
Oh, okay. Well,
Did you Google them?
No, I haven't yet.
All right.
Okay. I'll Google it before tonight.
Quite a scary prospect.
Yeah. Martin Degville, I think, was the lead singer. He wore kind of like...
Fishnet stocking over his face.
Over his face.
And
they had two drummers.
Pinky orange hair.
And what was it? Was it Tony James? There was a music journo who was basically... It was kind of like a knockoff Frankie. It was very much on the coattails of Frankie, I think. Yeah. Anyway, I got excited about the fact they had two drummers, which is obviously twice as good as one. Same old Cabbage points out, there are loads of bands who've had that set up, and he put a link. I was interested to read. Okay, Janzik says Glitter Band. They had two drummers. That's how they got that fat, thumping sound. Camp As You Like... says, James Brown wore the Glitter Band, whose two drummers played exactly the same thing. I know we don't mention them, says Camp As You Like, but the sound was magnificent. But I give you the Allman Brothers Band, who had two drummers between 68 and 82, but in the years between 1989 and 2014, according to Wikipedia, they had three. Boom. I can't think of an Allman Brothers song that would necessitate in any way
a surplus of percussion.
The Allman Brothers. Listen to the music. That was the Allman Brothers, wasn't it? Didn't Greg Allman just die, sadly? I think he did. Yeah. Drummers, are fitter than footballers, says scientists, says producer Ben, who's keen to get us back onto the putative subject matter of this podcast. Sorry, Sasha.
I was just going to mention my friend went to see a band on Saturday night called The OCs. They have two drummers.
Oh, yeah. How about that?
Some drummers are footballers, like Peter Cech, of course.
That's true. Can Phil Collins play football? He's the best drummer, isn't he? If you're talking about drummers, Phil Collins.
Just going to nod.
Keith Moon's the greatest drummer of all time.
Yeah, he was probably better than Phil Collins, to be fair. Although, could he use a fax machine? I don't know. Phil could. Yeah. I think we've run out of material.
Women's Champions League final?
Oh, yeah. Lyon against PSG. Did you go to that one as well, Paco? Because that was in Cardiff, wasn't it?
Unfortunately, I could. I've been to a couple before when they were Wembley finals.
Oh, yeah.
This was a rematch of actually the French Cup final, which was only a week earlier, which Lyon also won on penalties. And one thing that really annoyed me about that was the PSG goalkeeper with an unpronounceable Polish name, Katarzyna Krzyszak, something. She basically spent the whole of the penalty shootout jumping about 4 yards off her line,
right,
to the extent that Camila Billy in the French Cup final started her run-up, stopped just before the ball, and this goalkeeper was halfway down the pitch. So she kept on doing this in the Champions League final as well, and I was so pleased to see that when she had to take a penalty, she scoffed it miles wide.
And then the opposing keeper came up and scored.
Yeah.
Brilliant. All right.
Because that's just cheating. You're supposed to get booked every time you come off your line, even in the shootout.
Where was that played?
I think it was in the Cardiff City Stadium.
Okay. What kind of attendance?
22.
Oh,
that's good.
Yeah, I've been to... They played in Craven Cottage in 2011. That was about 10,000. I think they played Chelsea 2 years later when Wolfsburg beat Lyon. That was about 20, I think. Cheap tickets, like, but still people go.
Did any broadcasters pick that up?
No, I don't. Yeah. I was trying to find somewhere to watch it. I couldn't.
All right.
Not even BBC. So Lyon win their second treble in a row.
Right, because PSG had more misses.
Woof.
Sasha, I'm so glad you're here, because to finish off this kind of last regular season pod, we're going to have a little word about the Confederations Cup, which, yes, we will be covering, Sasha. And we're going to talk about that after this. Glad that's out of the way. Sasha, the Confederations Cup, it's coming up soon, isn't it?
Yep. I believe you have to do some podcasts.
Yeah. But we would have been anyway, even if it wasn't contractually necessary.
Yeah, it's a tournament, even as a Russian, I find very hard to get excited about.
What?
Because it's just been... They've been struggling to sell tickets. I think they only sold about a quarter about 2 months ago. I saw the numbers. Yeah, they're struggling to sell them. The stadium in St. Petersburg has been just catastrophic. As I mentioned on the pod last time I was on, Zenit moved into the stadium, had to move out because the pitch was terrible. So now they roll the pitch out.
Ah.
As you remember, they did that for the 2008 Champions League final, and John Terry fell over. So that was sort of damage limitation. Russians have loads of people out injured. Opening game is Russia-New Zealand. Woohoo. So, I'm sorry. I mean, maybe I should perhaps talk it up a bit more.
Let's go again from the top.
An article, I think, either in The Observer yesterday or The Guardian today about that stadium.
The St. Petersburg one.
Yeah. They got cheap labour in from North Korea build it, and the dreadful conditions those workers were forced to live in, and they get paid $10 or $15 a day, I think, some of which has to be sent back to the powers that be in North Korea to go towards the funding nuclear missiles and whatnot. And it seems like a very bad business all around.
This is off the back of the Josie Maher article that came out, I think, a couple of months ago, where they actually did some proper journalism, not this whole like hooliganism stuff. They actually properly went in and looked at the conditions of what effectively is migrant labor in Russia. And I mean, I was surprised that there were North Koreans at the stadium there, but I don't think anyone in Russia was particularly surprised by the findings, i.e. you get lots of migrant labor, laborers who live, you know, under conditions that aren't the best, contracts that come and go. And this is not just in stadium building. This is, you know, you see it in all walks of life or in all those sort of walks of construction. I mean, for example, we had a dacha outside Moscow, and every year there's a bunch of guys from Turkmenistan who'd come over and do like the odd jobs around there. But, you know, they're not coming in on any contracts or anything like that. They're just trying to pick up some work.
Right.
And yes, I mean, I think in Russia, you know, as we've seen in this country, the word migrant immediately provokes quite a toxic reaction.
Although I see that there've been efforts to welcome people of other different, you know, backgrounds.
I think you're referring to Sochi.
Yeah.
I think they did it with the best intention.
Right.
They just didn't do it very well.
Okay, this is things we've seen similarly back in the 90s in Italy of fans or indeed players in the case of, I think, Treviso blacking up to welcome say a player of African descent.
In solidarity after they'd suffered racist abuse was in Treviso's case, I think.
But is there not like a widespread feeling of excitement in Russia that after a lot of controversy and many doubts that they're about to stage a major event?
I think for Confederations Cup, it's just not there. It's a big friendly tournament. It's not even big friendly tournament. It's just a friendly tournament. I don't feel there is any excitement there about it at all. And interestingly as well, Infantino came over last week to just sort of visit, you know, see how he's getting on for the World Cup. And instead of taking him to a World Cup stadium, they took him to Krasnodar, which is a privately built stadium, mm-hmm. very nice stadium. Presumably they were telling him, oh, this is a privately built stadium. Look how good it is. Imagine what the next year is going to be like at all these beautiful new arenas.
But Krasnodar's not featuring.
Yeah, I think there was... I think apparently there was some sort of a meeting, maybe like at a very high level, and they sort of pointed at the Krasnodar owner Galitsky, saying, oh, I can probably use your stadium, you know, when he was still building it. And he went, yeah, whatever. And then it turned out it was too small. So I think it's a bit, because I think he's quite independent and he did his own thing and built his own club and maybe didn't suck up to the right people. He got a sort of, Krasnodar got sidelined when it came to the World Cup. Mm. And it has actually caused quite a major controversy in Russia because, you know, compare Krasnodar to somewhere like Saransk. What's Saransk? It's a town of 300,000 people in the middle of a region which is only notorious for its penal colonies. And it's laughable that they've got the World Cup, but, you know, somewhere higher up.
Where is that?
Saransk, it's, I think, it's southwest of Moscow. It's basically, it's the middle of nowhere. Right. And their team...
It's like Feltham.
Yeah, it's okay. Nondescript, it's rubbish. And
so, okay, and we don't... it's going to be exciting to see which nation gets drawn to, you know, be based in that area. that's interesting, Sasha.
There is a migrant who is in St. Petersburg now, but definitely isn't cheap labour.
Right.
And that's Roberto Mancini.
Oh, yeah.
Or there is another migrant in Russia who, when I first saw the news, I nearly fell off my chair. Stan Kolymor now works for Russia Today.
Yeah.
Presenting the whole World Cup, Confederation Cup this time around, preparation. Yeah. And when I first saw it, I went, it's just impossible to compute this.
So, sorry, Stan Kolymor is now working for Russia Today.
Yeah, so it's presenting the whole thing around the Confederation Cup.
But
did you want that gig, Jim?
Why no one asked you? I don't know, James. I'll have
the Daily Mail job not available or something? I mean, that's... I'm not going to make any comment because, you know, we've all worked for questionable people in the past or even currently. But
it looks like he's enjoying it. But he had Harry Kuehl on. When they were doing something in St. Petersburg, day before Harry Kuehl took the Crawley job, and didn't ask him anything on air. It was a complete surprise.
Okay, that's a revelation, Sasha. Thank you for that, and thank you for that full and frank preview of the Confederations Cup.
We're talking about it tonight as well, aren't we?
I doubt it. Not after that. But can you... I wonder, James, can you name the, what is it, eight nations? I don't know. Is it eight nations?
It's eight, yeah.
Eight. Can you name the eight nations involved in the Confederations Cup?
Germany.
Sasha, I'm looking
at
you.
Yeah, they're bringing half the squad. Yeah.
Chile.
Yep.
France, Brazil. No.
No.
Russia.
It's only the winners. Well, Russia.
New Zealand.
Yep.
Yep.
African Cup of Nations winners.
Cameroon.
Oh, Cameroon.
Oh, Portugal.
Yep.
And Portugal. I have to say that to me reads like a terrific lineup of footballing talent. A little kind of an amuse-bouche ahead. Oh, we got two more to go. Mexico.
One more to go.
And an Asian team. Is it Australia, Barry?
After clue.
I believe Australia are there. But hang on, how come New Zealand are there? Oh, there is
Oceania. Yeah.
Of course. Oceania.
Oceania, is it Oceania?
I don't know. Oceania. I don't think anyone actually knows. It's like GIF and GIF. Wow. As I say, that to me sounds just...
If only do a podcast.
I like a bit of Confederations Cup. You can kind of dip in, dip out. Sasha's don't have to worry about missing anything.
Exactly. And you know, you're being all high and mighty now, fresh off the train from Cardiff. But give it a month until absolutely nothing's happened. You'll watch it.
I'll be there glued to my screen.
All
Russia,
right.
New Zealand. Woof.
Okay, where are the games being played in Russia? Just Moscow, St. Petersburg?
They're doing St. Petersburg. They're doing Sochi. They're doing Kazan, a stadium that's been used by Rubin Kazan about 12 times in 3 years. Just sort of there, mothballed. They're not getting enough fans. And Otkritie Arena, which is the Spartak Moscow stadium in Moscow, which is perhaps the best of the new builds. Spartak get healthy crowds, just won the league as well. So I think it's probably got the best rep of the new grounds.
All right. Okay, when's it all happening?
17th of June till the 2nd of July.
Right, so it's actually quite soon.
Yeah. How many podcasts are you doing?
Well, fantastic.
I think we're doing
six
podcasts. Six
podcasts, okay.
But, you know, we're not constrained to specifically talk about Confederations Cup. We certainly will be, but I imagine we'll also be running up some of the other, you know, bits of news.
I'll try to sound more excited then.
Yeah, that would be great. That, though, I believe, brings us to the end of this edition of Football Weekly. and this season. Andy Follis says, have you got a highlight, funniest moment of the last 9 months? Anybody?
Well, highlight and the best and the funniest is Carsten Rump, the assistant manager at Arminia Bielefeld, who were getting relegated, well, who were in the relegation zone in the second Bundesliga, and they were due to play Eintracht Braunschweig, who were third, and they really had to win this game. And you just if you haven't seen it, just YouTube this 1 minute of the most inspirational speech you've ever seen before the start of the match. And then Arminia came out and battered Eintracht 6-0. It was amazing.
Right.
Obviously, Arminia named after Arminius, the ancient German hero who destroyed Roman forces in the Battle of Teutoburg Forest.
That's enough information, Sasha. time for us all to go, because we've got a live show to prepare for. That's Monday night at the Emmanuel Centre. You might find tickets on the door, might you? No? Okay, that's the Monday night at the Emmanuel Centre. We're going to be back on the stage in Dublin at the National Stadium on Wednesday. I think there might be one or two upper-tier tickets there. Yeah. So if you wanted. But for now, that's it. So many thanks to Sasha Gurionov.
Thanks for having me.
To James Horncastle.
Cheers, Jimbo.
To Barry Glendenning.
Thanks, Jimbo.
To producer Ben, and you, listener, for all your support through this long season. We'll be back soon. Have a great time till then.
The Guardian.